Monster Man, special episode, Berserkers and Barbarians. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Seb. If you'd like to be like Seb and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for all other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Seb, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy today's episode. The question that Seb asked for today's episode is twofold. To talk about the idea of berserkers, furious, raging fighters, and how this ties into the presentation of so-called, you know, quote-unquote, uncivilized cultures. Seb asks, what do we lose if we ditch the popular image of the berserk? And furthermore, you know, how do we avoid the stereotypes in our games? And I thought that what I would do is start with a background, kind of both of the history of these concepts and of the history of their use in D&D. So let's start with the barbarian class. One of the things that I find really interesting to do is to look at unofficial material from the game's early days, because it frequently reflects a perceived lack in the game. So the things that people are creating and putting into fanzines are things that they would like to see in the main game, but they feel are absent. And I believe the first character class in White Dwarf, when White Dwarf was, you know, focused mainly on Dungeons and Dragons, was a barbarian. And obviously this comes from fans of Conan the Barbarian wanting to play a Conan-like character, looking at the game and not being quite able to figure out what class he should be. The association of Berserk Fury with the barbarian is not present in many of these early attempts to do a barbarian class. Barbarian classes are proposed early on for D&D. Barbarians turn up in Unearthed Arcana for AD&D first, and they become sort of part of the kind of starting character creation in AD&D second. And in second, I believe there are some versions of the barbarian, because that game had a lot of proliferation of kind of character class options, a thing that is commonly thought of as like a failing of third, but I believe it's pretty present in second, although second's probably the edition I know the least about. There are barbarians who have this kind of like berserk quality, but it doesn't become sort of the distinctive feature of the class until third edition. And third, fourth, and fifth all keep barbarian rage as central to the barbarian. So you can play a berserker in D&D 5th edition. A berserker is even ragier than a regular barbarian, but the barbarian rage exists in all barbarian subclasses. It is the thing that distinguishes barbarians from their kind of fighter and ranger counterparts. In earlier versions of the barbarian, the focus is more on having a low level of technology, being suspicious of civilized pursuits, particularly magic, and having kind of like outdoorsy skills. And at high levels, barbarians got the ability to summon a barbarian horde, which was kind of around the level where fighters start getting castles and whatnot. Their own form of military power in a world where it was not imagined that they would build permanent strongholds. This is interesting because it suggests that barbarism is something that the game doesn't have a consistent idea of how to portray. If the barbarian in first edition is a rugged outsider, suspicious of the wiles of civilization, and the fifth edition barbarian is an axe-wielding maniac with a bear totem, those feel like very different concepts of what it means to be barbarian, and yet we recognize them both as falling within the cultural stereotype. So what is this idea of a barbarian? Well, initially, it's just a term that is used to put people outside the kind of civilized pale of classical antiquity, including quite civilized people. Again, big quotation marks around civilized there. In Greek thought, you basically had all the different peoples in the world and all the ways in which they were inferior to Hellenes. So you had barbarians in the west who were too wild and violent. You had your Persians and whatnot in the east who were too civilized and refined. And then you had your Hellenes in the middle who were just right. You can see similar attitudes manifesting later on in, for instance, the British Empire, although obviously that's like inspired by adapting classical literature into this sense of superiority that justifies, you know, that's how you excuse the fact that you're dominating and exploiting all these other people. They didn't necessarily use the term barbarian, but they certainly understood themselves as being on a different level of civilization than the people that they conquered, and therefore entitled to control them. The thread that both the like Greek idea of barbarism and the imperialist idea of like primitiveness have in common is the idea that the people that they are ruling over lack self-control. They are too emotional, too impulsive, short-sighted, gullible, superstitious, violent, and therefore they need a form of external control, whereas British people, who are extremely well emotionally regulated, don't need to be ruled like that. Also, rich people are more emotionally well regulated than poor people, but that's a different story. So the idea of the savage, this character who has no self-control, is strongly connected to the idea of uncontrollable emotion. So I guess you could say that that ties into the idea of the barbarian's furious anger, even though that wasn't particularly the stereotype that like either of these groups used, although there was some sense the barbarians were more kind of like naturally warlike. Your Western barbarians, your, you know, chest thumping Celts and whatnot. Now, you will read that this stereotype flips into the idea of the noble savage following the discovery of America or whatever, right? But actually, the idea of using quote-unquote barbarians as a way to critique the civilization that you're part of is as old as the idea of barbarians itself. You can see this in Greek and Roman art, where the figure of the dying Gaul is meant to be this kind of tragic figure. You can see this in Tacitus's Agricola, where Tacitus puts speeches critical of the Roman Empire into the mouth of quote-unquote barbarian leaders. The idea that in its civilization, our civilized, again, quote-unquote, culture has lost something, has got out of touch with nature, with ourselves, and that these people have something to teach us. Now, of course, this goes into overdrive when Europeans make contact with Native American cultures, but it was always present in writers who, when encountering so-called like less refined cultures, praised their hardiness and self-sufficiency, their community spirit, their courage, their appreciation of nature, their honesty, etc., etc., etc. We've become corrupt through wealth and idleness. These people live a hard, simple life, but aren't they in fact better people than us? I bemoan from the terrace of my palazzo. But this attitude toward the barbaric is at the root of the D&D barbarian, because this is the idea at the heart of Conan the Barbarian, right? Robert E. Howard was kind of a cowboy romantic decadent, and he scorned civilization, right? Quote-unquote civilization he saw as the refuge of conformists and bootlickers, you know, those who were willing to be trampled on by arbitrary authority or submit to the whim of public opinion and not just like wear a stupid hat whenever they felt like it. I'm poking fun at Howard a little because he sort of invites it. But the truth is that this was not an uncommon attitude, this idea that venerated so-called uncivilized people. You can actually see this a lot in the sort of discourses of fascism, although that's a whole other thing. You would think that the rules and regulations, uniforms for everybody, order und discipline guys would not be in favor of savagery, but they kind of were. It's a whole thing. Anyway, Conan represents Howard's ideal uncivilized man. He's intuitively, not unintelligently, in touch with the world around him. He is hardy, he's self-reliant, he's brave, and he's mostly honest. And if I wanted to contextualize the barbarian's rage, I would say that it is a way to mechanize Conan's primal ferocity. Conan is more like in touch with his natural self than his civilized counterparts. And so in moments of crisis, he responds with this instinctive physicality, which Howard is always comparing to a panther. But that presence in the moment, that instinctive physicality, gives Conan a physical edge over his opponents that is psychological in origin. It's not that he is bigger or stronger. It's not that he is trained better to fight, but there's something in his connection to his own nature that gives him the extra oomph that he needs to get out of all these scrapes that he's constantly finding himself in. And I don't know how you would describe that in the game, but I do feel like the Barbarian Rage sort of has a similar effect in that there is a thing inherent to the barbarian that the barbarian can do to make themselves perform physically above and beyond for a limited period of time, which is sort of something that happens a lot in Conan stories, even though Conan doesn't go into a rage. Conan remains lucid. Of course, raging barbarians remain lucid. They're not out of control. The player still controls them and can end the rage if they want to. So one of the things that underlies the barbarian is this idea that we see in Howard's Conan, which is that quote-unquote uncivilized peoples do have many of the qualities that their colonial overlords criticize them for. It's just that from Howard's perspective, those are good things. And this is the romantic view generally. Some British writer says, these people have no self-control, you know, they're emotional and passionate and drunken. Some 19th century romantic says, yes, we are, and that's great. So from like the period of like the 18th to the 20th centuries, I think this is a bit different now. I think these debates have changed and gone on into different modern forms. So for example, in like 18th and 19th century Britain, there's a lot of writing about how Irish people are too emotional. They're passionate and excitable and sentimental, and you know, they need level-headed Anglo-Scottish people to govern them. But then as romanticism becomes a thing throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, we start to see the exact same stereotype, but presented as positive, that Irish people are more emotional than their stuffy, repressed British neighbors. It's the exact same stereotype. It's just been spun to be a positive thing. People tell you that stereotypes have a basis in reality, and I'm not so sure about that. I think stereotypes have a basis in what it would be convenient for at least one side in the relationship to believe. But regardless of that, those stereotypes have an important influence on the literature that influences the game that we're talking about, and on the way that people imagine the past. So, for instance, let's take a look at the Old Norse berserk, because, I mean, the Fifth Ed barbarian even uses the term berserker. The furious fighting savage, quote-unquote, in the Monster Manual is called a berserker. The berserk lies at the heart of this, and the berserk is a fascinating literary archetype. Now, James, you said literary archetype rather than historical phenomenon. I did, thank you for noticing, because there is a lot of debate over whether this warrior who enters a sort of battle trance during which they shrug off injuries and fight with the strength of 10 and so forth exists as a historical phenomenon at all. And even the thing that exists as a literary trope doesn't seem to be quite like what we imagine it. So I'm mainly drawing my argument here from Roderick Dale's book, The Myths and Realities of the Viking Berserk. I'm not saying you should go out and buy it because academic textbooks are expensive. I got a free one, which is the only reason that I was able to read it. But I do recommend reading some of Dale's other work. I believe his thesis is online for free, and he's written about the Berserk issue on his site, Berserkia Blog. So it's definitely worth looking up. Anyway, Dale argues that there are characters in the sagas who go into an uncontrollable frenzy and aren't vulnerable to physical attack, but they are not always or even often referred to as berserks. And there are characters who are described as berserks who howl and gnash the edge of their shields and have animal symbolism, but they are not described as what we would think of as going berserk. Instead, they seem to be performing a kind of ritual or ceremonial set of actions. So we get things like howling and gnashing the edge of their shields, and then stopping to have a conversation with somebody. So they're clearly not whipping themselves into an uncontrollable frenzy. And even then, the sources that we're relying on, the Icelandic sagas, are being written centuries after the events they describe when they're talking about the Viking Age. There are sagas that are contemporary with the like medieval events that they talk about. But when the sagas write about the Viking Age, they're writing about historical events. And if we see anything that is like a pagan cultural practice, we have to remember that it's being written about by Christians who may not have a detailed knowledge of it. So I'll come back to Dale in a second, but I don't want to use this to do away with the idea of the berserker as we commonly understand it, right? The idea of a furious warrior who enters an altered state of consciousness, doesn't feel pain, and attacks with wild rage, like, is a pretty compelling one. Fighting someone like that would be scary. And playing someone like that lets us play with the idea on an emotional level. It's about letting out the rage that we normally try to bottle up or work on. And on a tactical level, it has this interesting question of having the ability to power up for a short period of time, but when do you use it? It would be nice to incorporate that idea into a game. And I think that there are two ways to do it effectively. First, let's talk about like the cultural version. So again, to return to Dale's myths and realities, Dale explores the idea that the animal imagery of the berserk is part of this kind of culture of a warrior or militarized elite that adopted animal symbolism as a way to celebrate their own strength and courage, and that this was tied in some way to like ritual practices, that it could have included things like wearing animal masks, that there's references to particular kind of songs or chants, that there's references to dancing, performing some kind of sword dance or spear dance. And insofar as there was any kind of tradition of warriors working themselves up into a battle frenzy, and this is me, not Dale, it presumably was rooted in some kind of similar cultural context. Now, in his email, Seb mentioned berserks in Glorantha. And there are a couple of different kinds of warriors that we would think of as berserks or berserkers in Glorantha, the best fantasy setting. Best by a certain standard, and one of those standards is that it tends to look at what other games would treat as like mechanical or simply narrative archetypes in their cultural context. It has a kind of anthropological turn. Anyway, the most famous berserk type warriors in Glorantha are Stormbull berserkers. So Stormbull is a deity or spirit, depending on your perspective, responsible for the fight against chaos. And as Stormbull in Praxian culture, or as Orlanth's brother Urox in Hjortland culture, he is the patron of warriors who fight against chaos. And in Hjortland culture, and I think also in Praxian culture, which I know less about, but in Hjortland culture, Stormbull berserkers are an awkward bunch. All the kind of specialized fighters, you know, members of specialized warrior cults, are a bit off. Both the Orlanthi and Praxian cultures have warrior traditions, and they view those Stormbull or Uroxy warriors as something a little different. They're needed to fight chaos, but by the very dint of that, their kind of like rowdy, uncontrollable behavior makes them unfit, or at least imperfectly fit, to participate in normal society. The perception of Stormbulls among the Orlanthi is that they're a bunch of rowdy drunks, bullies, and troublemakers, but unfortunately you want them around when you have to fight chaos. This also helps to emphasize the unique nature of chaos, something that cannot be fought as effectively just by the regular warriors of the tribe, no matter how brave they might be. Only fighting so hard that you become as much animal as human is going to work. So this takes the idea of going berserk away from being a description of a culture and makes it a cultural practice. So it's not that the warriors of this tribe go berserk, but that there is a particular tradition of warriors who induce an altered state of consciousness in order to give them exceptional fighting skills, exceptional bravery, and magical protection from their enemies. And that works here because, of course, they do need those things if they're going to fight chaos. Now, there's still the idea of associating this kind of violence with non-urbanized culture, which again, it just sort of stigmatizes difference, right? Oh, those primitive people with their uncontrollable rages. The crude brutality of the barbarian is contrasted with the tactical knowledge and advanced weaponry of the fighter, which is fine as long as the fighter isn't the kind of European by default combat class. But a little weirdly, the fighter types have these cultural aspects attached to them in a way that is maybe less true of others. I mean, it's 50-50. Some classes have them and some don't. But, like, you can tell where on the globe a monk comes from. And the paladin, I realize paladin's a cleric type, not a fighter type, in 5th. It's a fighter type in earlier editions. But a paladin, obviously, is influenced by kind of, like, the imagery of the Crusades. It would be fun to think about how a more lawful quote-unquote lawful culture, a more urbanized state culture, deals with the cultural phenomenon of the berserk, right? It would seem like berserk behavior would be antithetical to that culture's otherwise kind of rule-bound society. Is it a particular deity who touches mortals with his fury? Is it a military leader who experimented on her troops with mental programming techniques? You could argue, I think, that if you were going to translate, say, Warhammer to D&D, the barbarian class, obviously a bunch of like chaos marauders and things would be in the barbarian class, but also so would the flagellants, the penitent religious zealots who whip themselves into a state of religious ecstasy and then feel no pain or exhaustion as they swing their heavy flails at the enemy. You can actually see a parallel to that in Glorantha as well, where the equivalent, I guess, to a storm bull in the northern cultures of Darahapa would be devotees of Shargash, the red god, who are valued for their strength and courage, but stigmatized as violent madmen by the rest of Darahapan society. So that's the cultural approach. We can think of going berserk as a cultural phenomenon and separate it from what we understand about barbarians, even though the Orlanthi and Glorantha are kind of analogous to, you know, non-urbanized, they have cities, but it's a whole thing, but kind of when they think of what their real identity is, they think of these kinds of like tribal dispersed village environments and lots of like cattle raiding and what have you. They don't think of themselves as urbanized people, even though they do have cities. But although they are barbarians, quote unquote, their society is just as rule-bound and civilized as the society of their lunar opponents, and their berserks are a destabilizing influence to that society, which is the reason they don't like it. The berserk idea becomes one cultural stream or role within a complex interaction of different cultural elements, rather than, oh, they're a savage people. Their warriors fight with unrelenting fury. Alternatively, we could take this and make it not a cultural phenomenon, but a psychological one, an individual one, right? How do you deal with the idea of making, whatever, being berserk, an individual trait? And I think that you have to kind of steer away from the cultural explanation. And I think it can work if you steer away from the cultural explanation and root it in the individual. So, you know, you're fighting a bunch of Viking analogs in your game. Most of them are just normal people. Most of them are just soldier types who have a spear or a bow and some arrows or whatever. And then you have Snorri. And Snorri's a wild man. And everybody else feels the same way about him that you do, right? Like the other soldiers are like, man, you better watch out for Snorri. That guy, we can't control him. And I think that has a link to like other types of narratives, other types of media where we discuss violence, right? So like think about gangster movies where there's often like the one wild man, or Lord of the Flies, where most of the kids are just kind of, you know, mean and will go along with whoever tells them what to do. And Jack is a petty wounded bully who just likes to shove people around. And Roger is a monster. The idea that there is this character whose violence is excessive by the standards of the people around them, but who's still valuable because of their like great prowess. You could argue, I think, that some portrayals of Sir Gawain are a bit like that, where his fairy strength is combined with his kind of like short-tempered and vengeful personality to suggest that he goes into an uncontrollable rage. I don't think that's present in the medieval sources, but that is a read that some modern authors have made on him. In the film Outlaw King, you could say that that's how the Black Douglas is portrayed, as this guy who goes on a rampage once the fighting starts. And it might be a little weird that there are so many people who just have like a boiling cauldron of inner rage that you run into barbarians and berserkers all the time, but you don't have to. The PCs in my 5th edition game have very seldom run into members of their own classes, except for the cleric, who's run into a ton of other clerics, because clerics are an important part of this society, but barbarians sort of aren't. And it is very much, in her case, played as an individual psychological thing. If you went back to Daisy May, the character's called Daisy May, there's a whole bit about how it's spelt like D-E-I apostrophe Z-I hyphen M-E-I, you know, but it's, yeah, Daisy May. If you went back to Daisy May's village, you would not find that it was full of other barbarians, right? It's just full of ordinary people. It's Daisy May specifically who has this like bubbling cauldron of rage underneath her like sweet girl next door behavior. Daisy May will be super nice and friendly and super nice and friendly and super nice and friendly, and then something sets her off and she just gets so angry. And there, I guess the barbarian's thing becomes not cultural, but about being motivated by anger, about how we all keep our anger pent up, right? And then release it at an appropriate moment. Like when Daddy hit the referee with the whiskey bottle. Remember? When Daddy hit the referee? The character I have most recently compared Daisy May to is Mr. Furious from The Mystery Men. His power comes from his boundless rage. I realize this is not how Mr. Furious works. I realize the whole point is that his power doesn't come from his boundless rage. That's just what his girlfriend says. But the idea of a character whose power comes from some kind of like inner psychological thing that they can turn into bursts of almost superhuman power, harnessing a dark side to give them strength, I think is fun on an individual level and can work divorced from any kind of cultural context if you're playing the kind of game where, you know, this character class is important because there's a barbarian in the party. All right, I talked about Glorantha. I talked about my game. I talked about The Simpsons. I've talked about Mystery Men. I haven't talked about Wolverine. I think we've covered Berserkers and Barbarians. So Seb, thank you very much for the fascinating prompt, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Seb and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look not at a specific monster, but at a way of working with monsters. How do you cast your dungeon? So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.